hope, done sensibly, is that the incentives for investment and economic growth will bring in enough growth and therefore tax revenue.
So this was kind of the big social media story in the news. Twitter said that it is based on the behavior of an account. So if an account looks particular...
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch, the Wednesday afternoon edition. Terry Savage is in the studio. We'll go over Wall Street, budget cuts, and all of that a little bit later. Frank Sennett will be here. And have you looked at the ballot? Are you ready? You know, the midterm elections are fewer than 3 weeks away now. Sarah Rosier is the news editor at Ballotpedia. That's one of those sites where, go do it now. You can go online and put in your address and all of that, and they'll tell you who's running in the offices where you live. And you can sort of get an advance notice on how you might want to vote. They've got candidate bios, but more than anything else, they just got sort of a look at your ballot. So we'll talk to her a little bit later in the program. We'll start with Terry Savage. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
I am glad to be here. I'm watching the markets, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average now down, and I say really honestly, only 8 points. So we were down
amazing.
Over 300, I saw.
First of all, thank you for filling in for me last week.
Oh, Steve, I had so much fun.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
I had to bring in four people to push all the buttons that you're busy pushing, though. So I think that's my queen for a day. I want to do it like once or twice a year.
Okay, so the Dow was down 319 points, I think, at the low today. And it's come back to, if not in positive territory, getting very close now, down 17.
Okay. Percentage-wise, you know my speech, you could give it. Percentage-wise, this is a small percentage today. Even 300 points either way is a relatively small percentage move in the Dow. For those of us who remember when the Dow was like 1,000
sure.
or 2,000, a 300-point move was like the end of the world. The other thing is we've got a lot of crosswinds now. There's good news on the earnings front. And there are concerns. The concerns, as I said last week, basically revolve around, you know, the headline is interest rates. That's a competitive thing for stocks. But more important, I think there's concern not only about what the Fed will do to raise rates. We'll see the minutes this afternoon of how closely their call was to say, yes, we're going forward with interest rate moves in the future. It's also concerned about what happens to corporate profits going ahead. So you have things like interest is a component of business, so that raises a cost. Tariffs on many raw materials are a component of business. Retail products imported that might be hit by tariffs are a component of sales for retailers. And the question is, will all these companies, A, raise prices to recoup the higher costs? Oh, and wages, by the way, I should add, a fact that we're having higher wages now, lower, it's harder to attract workers, so you have to pay more, even the minimum wage is going up. All those are costs. The big question for stocks is, will those companies raise their prices to recoup their profit margins so that next quarter in the year, the next quarter after that, they can show, yes, our profits are still on the rise, or are they going to say, oops, we can't raise prices, so our profit margins are squeezed.
So
and that's where we are right now.
Is this Terry Savage with the wet blanket on this good news, economic news?
No, I'm just saying that, if you want to be Pollyanna, everything is perfect right now.
Thank
companies,
you. I prefer that. It's so much more comfortable that way.
Call me Pollyanna. Everything's fine right now. Earnings reports are coming in. The economy's still growing strongly. The tariffs don't seem to have had an impact. We can ignore higher interest rates. We can ignore the fact that the good news, of course, that people are getting jobs and there are a lot of job openings that aren't even being filled. That's all great for today. Unfortunately, the stock market looks ahead.
Well, but Netflix, we can go home tonight and watch Netflix.
Great. And sign up. Get your neighbors to sign up because they're the leading indicator
Isn't that amazing
of the millennial
that, I mean,
economy.
Well, here's this company that was left for dead so many times, and they're leading the charge today, bringing things back after a strong report.
Yeah, but they got hit, too, on fears that they're rebounding because there were fears that maybe their growth was leveling off. Look, one stock does not a market make, even one group of stocks like the tech stocks, just that there's a lot of money in that sector. It was highly overweighted in the S&P 500. And so when you're getting down to the point where the portfolio managers have to worry about their year-end performance. Where did they have the big gains? They had them in tech stocks. Maybe they don't want to show so much exposure, lock in some gains. And by the way, that's good advice for you, not just the portfolio managers. It's not like you're reporting to the world and people are going to judge you. You're reporting to your own retirement.
president today just spoke not too long ago in the Oval Office, and he said one of the things is he's going to require each of his cabinet positions, each of the different departments in the government, to cut spending next year by 5%.
Oh, well, that's very good. He's running it like a business, in quotes, so where you can order people around. I hope the cabinet secretaries each have to get at least a 5% cut in their pay and in their perk spending. Maybe you should just start with lopping that off. Look, I don't think here's the deal. This year that just ended last week, or 2 weeks ago, September, at the end of September, we had a $782 billion budget deficit for the year. Now, way back in 2009, 2010, we had $1 trillion budget deficits because the government was spending money to keep businesses afloat. We're in good times, growth times. We had a $782 billion deficit versus $666 in 2017. These are MIGO numbers, folks. That stands for my eyes glaze over. But let me give you one more. If you go to truthinaccounting.org, there's a time clock, a debt clock. And I just did. And we're over $21 trillion in IOUs. Now you're going, so, well, okay, we've been doing that for a while. What's a big deal? Here's the deal. We pay interest on that debt. Remember a couple weeks ago I said, oh, buy Treasury bills. The government's paying a nice rate of interest. Okay, all those IOUs, that deficit is funded by IOUs. The government pays interest on them. Every one-tenth of an increase in interest rates, okay, so going from 2.5 to 2.6, overall, the whole budget deficit adds $164 billion to the 10-year forecast. If you get a 1% increase in interest rates, it's going to cost the government to pay, just if they don't build up any more debt, $1.6 trillion over the next 10 years in interest costs.
And not even the Mega Millions can help with that. Terry Savage
exactly.
is here. We're going to take a break. I want you to go downstairs during the break, see Patel in the Gateway store yeah. on the first floor.
Oh, downstairs?
Yeah, and buy us a Mega Millions ticket, and we'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. We are in the Allstate Skyline studio. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for listening. Terry Savage is in the studio as well. The Mega Millions jackpot now is $868 million. Do you play?
I'm going to.
Right.
I mean, that caught my
Isn't
attention.
It, but you're the money
the
person.
Is,
Isn't that throwing your money away?
That's absolutely throwing your money away. And I'm not stupid enough to think that by spending, you know, $10 instead of whatever it is, $1 or $2, see, I'm not a regular player, that I'm going to materially increase my odds. We think about all the people that just had to get their tickets before, what was it, Wednesday's drawing? Last night's drawing.
Yeah.
I mean, all those people, that's all money. It's not really thrown away, actually. Somebody's going to get it, and some states are going to get a cut of it. So but
yeah,
it's a really insidious form of taxation.
For me, I do buy lottery tickets when I'm around. And for me, it's worth a buck just to have the
daydream.
Dream of, yeah.
You know, when you start getting up into the, you know, I dream about $21 trillion budget deficits. I dream about what's going to happen to Chicago's pension fund deficits. When I think about billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars anyway, I'm always thinking about the problems.
You should dream about buying an island, not paying off the...
I like being here. Then I couldn't get a connection to you.
There was this, I think it was the Philadelphia Fed did a study a couple of years ago and said that if you live next to a lottery winner, you're more likely to go bankrupt.
Well, keeping up with the Joneses.
Isn't that something? Right. So
there's a thing on I'm a real addict of HGTV, but the one that really blows me away, and I don't watch it very often because it's so weird, is what my lottery winnings dream home. And you see what people
do. We're learning something about
something.
Terry Savage here. What is this show?
Oh, no, I love HGTV. You know, love it or list it, flip or flop. I'm really, because I can't stand anymore to have the news on in the background.
So what's the show? It's about lottery winners?
Well, they have one of their shows on their station where this weird, very crazy guy takes people to choose a home now that they can move out of their shack because they won $72 million or $12 million or whatever it is. And that's the first thing people think about is their home.
It's a new home. It's $868 million, so buy a ticket. I wish you luck, and I hope you'll come back even next week if you do win.
Do I have a minute?
You've got time, yeah.
Yeah, we do. Okay.
Yeah.
If I win, let me tell you this. I promise I'll come back.
Okay.
And I'm going to get to go on one of your Europe jaunts with you.
You don't have to.
Way.
Listen, that's the beauty of my trips, Terry. You don't have to win the lottery to
When's
be able to
When's your next
it.
Trip?
We got a trip for Dave Bennett to Italy next June that we just put up on my website,
stevebertrandtravel.com. So where do you find these trips?
Stevebertrandtravel.com.
Okay, cool.
Listen, I know you talked a little bit about this last week, but we're kind of in this season for insurance. And I think it was a year ago at this time, we were talking about insurance possibilities, health insurance for small businesses.
Yeah, you know, this is health insurance season. So I'm going to write a series of three columns, the first of which is up at terrysavage.com today. It was in the Tribune. It goes nationally syndicated by the Tribune content agency. The first one is about, I'm going to tell you in a minute, small business, an incredible deal that you might want to take advantage of, a special enrollment period for small business health insurance. Then I'm going to talk about Medicare sign up because you must, and that's next week's topic. You must absolutely go over your Part D. You may want to switch to an Advantage plan and back. So that's next week's, and then the Affordable Care Act. And what do you do if you can't get Affordable Care Act insurance at an affordable price? So here's the highlights. I had Alan Wishner of The Health Insurance Shop. The health insurance shop with an e.com on the end, or read the column at terrysavage.com. There is a unique program, a 1 month open enrollment mandated by the Affordable Care Act. The open enrollment, you could start researching it now, runs from November 15th to December 15th. Now get this. This is for small businesses that have at least two salaried employees, even though only one of those employees has to take it. Maybe the other one's on Medicare. This is a plan that says that you can get a group insurance plan, even if only one person takes it, that is equivalent, the same as all the best plans offered by the big corporations in your state. So that means you get to choose from HMOs, PPOs, you get the widest coverage of doctors and hospitals included in your network, unlike many ACA plans, which don't anymore. And the employer does not have to pay one penny. So if you're Joe and you run the Joe's Tool and Die Shop and you've got four employees, one of them says, no, I get a great subsidy. You don't pay me enough, Joe. I'm taking Affordable Care Act. The other one says, no, I'm working past my retirement age, so I'm getting Medicare. But the other one says, oh, this would be great. I can have this great plan. Yes, boss, you don't have to pay. In fact, the employee can pay pre-tax, so it even costs less. And if you have someone with a pre-existing condition, which usually jacks up your premiums, because this comes under the Affordable Care Act, even pre-existing conditions don't increase the premiums.
All right, so you wrote about that.
Go to terrysavage.com, read about the small business health insurance special enrollment period, and go to the health insurance shop, shoppe.com, or ehealthinsurance.com. But if you work for a company and half of employees of small businesses in Illinois don't get insurance through work, you're going to get a much better plan, probably less expensively than you could under the Affordable Care Act.
I want you to go take the elevator down to the first floor.
Go buy a lottery
ticket. Get on the escalator, then go down and buy the lottery ticket first, okay?
I'm going to do that.
We'll see you next week. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, here on 720 WGN. All right, Terry Savage did it. I sent her, she just emailed a picture to Bennett Wakenight, producer, and to myself, to me, of her buying a lottery ticket downstairs from Patel at the Gateway store. So with any luck at all, it will be the winning ticket, and she'll share it not just with Bennett and me, but also with Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch, Frank.
Thank you, Steve. I always go for the 50-50,
at the ballpark,
game.
Odds are better, probably. So we'll post that picture. We're going to post that picture of Terry buying the, one day, I think that's the case. Let's start with United Airlines, right? Oil prices have been going up quite a bit, and United, though, is sort of bucking the trend, right? They're doing okay despite those increasing oil prices.
Yeah, fascinating story from John Pletz. Despite the rising fuel prices that we're seeing, United Airlines is going to continue a strategy to add routes in the U.S. Next year they're adding 22, including weekend service from Chicago to Hilton Head, South Carolina. So one of our weekend road trips, that would be great.
Right.
And they added 40 new flights this year, so they're really adding a lot of flights. And the question is, hey, it may work at $50 a barrel of oil, but when it's $85 a barrel, how do you make money off of that? And so airlines like United and JetBlue have been raising fees, like $5 more to check luggage. And then also they are offsetting some of the fuel costs by shifting flights to larger aircraft, which paradoxically are more economical than the small regional planes. And
so United is saying
it's going to recoup all that.
I'm sorry, Frank. Louis Lazar was in a few weeks ago. We were talking about United, and they had added, I think it was flights to Champaign, that they ended up cutting back on because it was the same thing. The small jets weren't as economical as it was flying bigger jets to more popular routes.
Yeah, absolutely. So that, you know, they may have to look at that as the fuel prices continue to rise. If there are flights that would require the smaller planes, those wouldn't be the ones that would be on the bubble. But United said it was able to offset 100% of the increased fuel cost in the third quarter forecast, and that it will recover 90% of the year-over-year increase for the full year. So by making these moves with the fees rising and the larger planes, so far they are able to sidestep the rising price of oil.
Now, I know O'Hare's traffic is up, I think, about 5% so far this year. Is that because of additions from United?
Yeah, that's one of the things. They've added 35 flights to new or existing routes from O'Hare just in the past year, and that has helped to that nearly 5% increase in passengers through July from the previous year. And the capacity of United at its hubs in Chicago, Denver, and Houston is almost 10% higher in the third quarter from a year earlier. So they're growing everywhere they have a hub.
All right, so there's the guidance from United. Remember when the best food you could buy at O'Hare was McDonald's? That's not the case anymore. But McDonald's is in the news at Crane's as well, the story by Joe Cahill. And this has been, you know, it seems to me there always has been sort of friction between the franchisees and the bosses in Oak Brook, used to be, now in Chicago. But there's this growing movement to sort of form a franchisee organization, which, I mean, you think of it as a franchisee union, I guess, that might weigh some clout against Steve Easterbrook and the bosses of Chicago McDonald's. Explain that for me.
Yeah, so it's a balance of power story. And you're right, franchisees have complained about, you know, requirements for investment in infrastructure upgrades and menu pricing and things over the years. But really, it's always boiled down to McDonald's says, it's my way or the highway, and the franchisees had no choice but to comply. However, in its effort to boost profitability, McDonald's has shifted almost all of its outlets to franchisees. They control 95% of McDonald's restaurants, and it's also working with larger and larger franchisee groups. So there's more inherent power, and now some of them are banding together. 400 McDonald's franchises are forming an independent organization. McDonald's has always resisted these franchisee groups, but now with this shift in how the stores are owned and the larger owners of multiple franchisees banding together, there may be a lot more clout from these store owners to push back on things from, you know, renovation costs to menu pricing to ad campaigns, what have you. This is a nascent movement, so we don't know what the impact is yet, but it really is a huge change potentially in the power balance between McDonald's and its franchisees.
Right, so there would be franchisees and then company-owned stores. I think McDonald's at one time maybe owned like 20% of the restaurants out there were company-owned, and as you said, that's dropped, and as it goes, they lose some power to franchisees. So, like, for example, when I walk into the McDonald's on the Pedway here and look at the kiosk that I still can't figure out and walk past it, that's one of those things that McDonald's corporate is demanding that the franchisees pay for, right? You've got to put kiosks in your store. The franchisees might not necessarily like that, and that's the sort of thing that they could fight against.
That's right. The modernization campaign requires owners to spend hundreds of thousands of bucks per restaurant on the remodeling with those ordering kiosks and other technology. And some of the owners are saying these big expenditures are putting a lot of debt on them, a lot of interest payments, but they really haven't generated the increase in customer traffic that McDonald's promised. So, you know, where there's a gap, at least, you know, perception or reality between what McDonald's is, you know, promising they're going to get out of these initiatives and what they actually do get, that's where some of that potential friction could come in, and now the franchisees may have a stronger voice.
There are no high-tech kiosks at Architectural Artifacts, which has been running up in Ravenswood for more than 30 years, right? You go in there and buy some of the old stuff. I think movie producers would go in there, collectors and things like that. But the owner, Stuart Grannon, is hanging things up.
Yeah, after 31 years, it really has become an institution in Chicago. It's a really always a fun and funky place to go up in Ravenswood. And Stuart Grannon is closing down the physical shop, and he's going to have an auction with a preview running through November 2nd over at Architectural Artifacts. And then he's going to do some traveling, but he's still going to sell his finds through the Architectural Artifacts website. So he's shifting to online sales But this is a huge change.
Yeah, I've been up there.
I've been in there, and you can lose hours in that place.
You know, Tim Samuelson, who really is just a great Chicago historian and wonderful with words, he's quoted in this story by Jan Parr. He says that it's a place of beauty and joy combined with the melancholy of loss, which, you know, is because you walk around and sort of you lament that these pieces, these parts of us, aren't in use anymore. But it's wonderful to see them. And so we've got a little bit longer. Architectural Artifacts up in Ravenswood shutting down after 31 years. Frank Sennett, thanks for joining us today. Hope we can do it again next week.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Time now for the Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Wondering if you could afford a house? No, not a condo, not your friend's attic you've been crashing in for the last summer, but a legitimate house. Good news, Chicago is the second most affordable big city to own a home in. All right, fine, we took a bit of a runaround way of gaining that title, because since the housing crash, our Chicago homes have been some of the slowest to regain value, so it's kind of been affordable for a while. It's really the economy that's built itself back up to where a lot of people feel confident to buy again. Another feather in the Midwest hat, but let's keep it here in the Midwest, as a new fund has been created to bring capital to startups outside of the coasts. Comeback Capital officially has $2.25 million. It's nothing new that money is flowing to the heartland of America, but when big and little funding opportunities come around, that's when you know you can feel confident about starting that business you've been dreaming about for years. Who knows? Maybe the world needs a better way to check if there are donuts in the break room. There could be an app for that. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, here on 720 WGN. Frank Fontana and Kathy Hart coming up in just a few minutes as they fill in for John Williams today. But before that, we say hello to Sarah Rozier, the news editor at Ballotpedia.com. Sarah, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, so the midterms are less than 3 weeks away, and, you know, I'm old enough to remember when you would clip a sample ballot out of the newspaper and bring it with you. No longer the case there. A lot of websites that will help you not just decide how to vote, but just give you the information you need to vote. Ballotpedia is one of them. Tell me about what it is you do and your mission and why you're there.
Yep, so we are the online encyclopedia of American politics. Our goal is to deliver high-quality, accessible political and judicial information. We are founded in 2006, and our CEO and current president, Leslie Graves, saw a real need for just basic information for the average citizen, the average voter, to have, like you said, the information to be able to walk into their polling location and feel confident and comfortable in the decisions they are making.
Do you take
sides?
So
part of this for us.
Do you take
No, we are nonpartisan, neutral. We're a 501c3, so we maintain our neutrality and our nonprofit.
Sarah, the 501c3, that's no defense anymore, right? I know some of the most political organizations I know are charities like that. But yeah, I'm not challenging you, but you are neutral. People aren't going to go there and find a slant in one way or the other.
Yep, all of our research is done independently. We don't coordinate our research with any outside organizations, and we have very strict neutrality guidelines. But I definitely understand what you're saying.
Right.
We've done a whole project on the different IRS designations.
Have you? Oh, I'd love to read that. Is that still available at Ballotpedia?
It is, yep. If you search our website for 501c3, we did a whole influencers project, including a lot of these organizations and what designations they have, the differences between a C3, a C4, a PAC, a super PAC, and just the types of political spending that happens in elections.
That is one of my pet peeves, because there are so many organizations that hide behind the idea of being a charity or working toward the public good. And they're really just on both sides. They're just political organizations, and they skate by without paying taxes. So I'll look for that. I checked. I went on your page, and I put in my address, right? I put in my address, hit enter, and then I get the list of the races and with bios and pictures of everyone who's going to be on the ballot when I go to the polling place in just a few weeks. And that works for everyone in the United States, correct?
It does. So the way we've structured our content, We do cover everything from school board candidates and school board elections, local municipal elections, all the way up to, of course, congressional. The presidential in 2020 we'll be comprehensively covering. But for the local and school boards, we have to limit it to the largest 100 cities by population. But if you're in one of those, we have a full comprehensive ballot for you.
I just pulled up your homepage right before you came on, and I see something new there. And it's an invitation to join the online discussion group about Chicago's elections. So if people do that, what would they find?
Yeah, so I just put that up right before hopping on the call with you. So we've noticed that, especially since a lot of local newspapers are closing their doors, and just there's this void in some of these local elections coverage. And so we noticed Chicago is going to have this landmark mayoral race, yeah, and the city council. Every race in Chicago is going to be really interesting in 2019. So what we're trying to do is just gather a group of people, the participants in this discussion can talk about their ideas, their concerns, their priorities for the city, and we're just trying to set up a very Chicago-specific forum for anybody who's interested in discussing these elections.
I look forward to following that. Sarah Rozier, the news editor at Ballotpedia, let's keep in touch. Thanks for talking today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.